I believe the way things are is not the way things have to be.
We'll only really make things better when we all come together, when we all work together, when we all join together, when we work out that we're all in this together.
I'm telling you, you can't play politics with people's jobs and with people's services.
Hello and welcome to the Centre Think Tank's podcast, In Conversation. In this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by John Bowers, Principal of Brasenose College and author of a recently published or forthcoming book, Downward Spiral. Welcome to the podcast, John.
Hi, nice to be here.
It's wonderful to have you on. Now, the first question I'd like to ask is, what made you decide you wanted to write the book in the first place?
Well, I was concerned for some time about the decline in standards in public life, and that became even more so during the Johnson regime. I think what particularly drew my ire was the case of Priti Patel, who was criticised by the Independent Advisor on Ministerial Interest. The report was sat on for some 7 months. It wasn't even clear who'd written it, and she didn't resign. In fact, the only person who resigned was the Independent Advisor on Ministerial Interest. So I thought it was a good idea to write about this, particularly coming up to 30 years since the Nolan principles, and just see whether they were still adhered to or whether they needed to be updated, and whether our system of ethical regulation was fit for purpose.
And one of the things that you discuss in the first chapter of the book is about historic corruption or a lack of ethics in politics. How important do you think it is, making the point on how standards have fallen so far, it is to explain what we've seen in recent years is less of a new phenomenon in of itself, but rather the worst excessive version of that historic corruption?
I think there have always been times where there have been problems with public standards, not necessarily corruption in the legal sense, but lack of morality, lack of ethics. Although the Baldwin and Attlee period seems to have been relatively scandal-free, but the period of Boris Johnson in Number 10 was, I argue in the book, the most corrupt and immoral we've seen in the UK since Lloyd George. There was a brazenness about the misdoings. There seemed to be a tsunami of issues one after another. Maybe that was because of populism and the security of a big majority, although, of course, it was really lack of ethics that brought him down in the end. But I felt it was necessary to give a historical perspective in order to see what needed to be done to test whether the Johnson period was an aberration or whether it really was necessary to change our system, which for so long has relied on the idea that ministers, and in particular the Prime Minister at the heart of government, would be a good actor, or as Peter Hennessy would put it, a good chap.
And on Boris Johnson, you just mentioned, he's obviously a very controversial figure in many ways, regarded differently by different groups of people. You mentioned in the book certain feelings of warmth towards him in the run-up to the 2019 general election in Grimsby. What do you think it says both about the Conservative Party and of the political system at large, that someone with a record like his was able to become Prime Minister? Because he wasn't exactly scandal-free before he became Prime Minister, was he?
No, I mean, I don't want to be too party political about this, and the book really isn't a party political book. But I do think that it's indicative of a lack of checks and balances that he became the leader. But as you say, he did have and does have strength. So you mentioned Grimsby because that's my hometown. I've still got a house there. And I think what people there really liked about him was three things. Firstly, he simplified politics in a way that many politicians actually make it more complicated. Secondly, he had a sunny disposition and was not doom and gloomster, as he would have put it. And thirdly, he'd be a good person to have a beer with in a Grimsby hostelry. And I think people still feel that. But it is extraordinary that someone with his track record, which I look at in great depth, perhaps too much depth, in the book of misleading people, did come to the top. But I suppose at the end of the day, that is democracy. What I think it has exposed, however, what the book is really about, is that we can't rely on informal conventions and people behaving as good actors. We have to at least identify and codify the conventions that apply to prime minister, because there's very little in law about the position of prime minister, and make sure that those bodies which can adjudicate or comment on the prime minister are in statute and can't be abolished without a big row. And that particularly applies to the independent advisor on ministerial interests. So I think it was right to concentrate a great deal on him and his personality in presenting the book.
Indeed, and one particular area that seemed to grow under his time as prime minister, two particular types of roles were those of czars and non-executive directors. Could you explain what you mean by both of those roles and what the significance of their proliferation under Boris Johnson was?
I mean, the significance of it for the book is that neither of the roles fall within the public appointment rules, which are relatively strict, probably not strict enough, but are designed to prevent complete politicization of the roles and to allow the people that are appointed on merit. Czars are people who are appointed for particular, look at particular areas. Some, like the fracking czar, only lasted a couple of years, but others have been around for some time. For example, the czar for troubled families. And during COVID, the vaccines area, insofar as it wasn't Kate Bingham who was dealing with the sort of executive responsibility, was under the Tsar, Lord Dayton. They can have a real influence on policy. You know, they can do deep dives into particular areas. They're much commented on in the press, and there's absolutely no regulation at all. So the public appointment system can be completely subverted by setting up a Tsar. Non-executive directors have existed since the Blair government, but have been expanded further under this Conservative administration. The original idea was to bring business people in to give guidance to departments. I think it very much depends on the character of the Secretary of State as to how influential they are. But my investigations, and much of the book is based on interviews with insiders, some of whom are named and some of whom retained anonymity. But many of them told me that non-executive directors can be extremely influential. Lord Butler, the former Cabinet Secretary, told me he was very sceptical of the roles. But what the book does is to demonstrate that there's simply no coverage by the Commissioner for Public Appointments. So political cronies of ministers can and often are appointed. And what seems to be the case is that that became more acute under the Johnson government than it had been before.
Indeed, and another area that you look at that has been quite abused, I think is perhaps the nicest way of putting it, is lobbying. But to a degree, do you think that lobbying can be justified? Are there those who would, you know, argue that it can have a positive effect? It can be positive if it's done from a positive rather than a negative, selfish interest. Do you think that altruistic lobbying, if such a term can exist, can be a positive, and that to look at lobbying just in the sense of it being negative and self-interested and related to people making money can perhaps diminish the complexities of it as a term and as a part of our institution?
I absolutely agree, and it does partly depend on what we mean by lobbying. If you take it as a very wide definition of any action to influence the legislature or civil servants or special advisors, then it can enhance the democratic process because it enables legislators and civil servants to be better informed. Politicians simply don't have the resources to get across all the issues. I think it was actually quite well put by Sir Nigel Boardman in his review into the Greensill affair, when he said, and I quote, it can provide decision makers with insights and data and enables government to understand the impact of public policy on those it may affect. However, and this is a big however, it is necessary that the public know who is doing the lobbying, on whose behalf they are working, because it often happens in the darkness. And increasingly, pressure groups and indeed research institutions are really a disguised proxy for the lobbyists. And we just need to know that. So there's been a recent case of Scott Bentham, one of the Blackpool MPs, doing undisclosed lobbying for the gambling interest. It looks like he's going to lose his seat. Now, we have a regulation, and I say that in inverted commas, so the Registrar of Consultant Lobbyists, but he only covers a very small part of the industry because employed lobbyists aren't covered. Multidisciplinary organizations like law firms, which are increasingly operating in this area, aren't covered by him. So what I argue in the book is that we need more transparency throughout. I mean, it's ironic that it was David Cameron, when he was leader of the opposition, who said that lobbying was the next scandal waiting to happen. It was all about the words in the ear over lunch that people didn't know. It's ironic that he was a person who was at the heart of the Greensill scandal. I don't suppose he thought that would be the next scandal. But no, I think you're right. I mean, there is lobbying. I mean, you could say that one of the most influential lobbying organisations are the trade unions and indeed the big charities. But I think in those cases, we know exactly who they are. We know exactly what they're doing. It's more the insidious nature of the word in the ear away from the public gaze. And it's too easy for the registers be kept by civil servants to say things like general discussions, or if it's at a party event, and this is Conservative, Labour, Lib Dems, presume the Reform Party as well. It's just not recorded at all, and I think that's wrong.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. In the 12th chapter of the book, you deal with MPs having second jobs and a COBRA. And a COBRA is perhaps infamous, particularly if people read Private Eye, in seemingly being incredibly lax with the jobs and the time limits it puts on MPs taking those second jobs or going to jobs after they're no longer members of Parliament. What would you say are the major weaknesses of that current system?
I mean, the clue's in the name, because it's the Advisory Committee on Business Appointments. It shouldn't be advisory. It should be compulsory, and it should have powers to enforce. There's a lot of politicians, including the aforementioned Boris Johnson and George Osborne, in fact, who didn't put their jobs through ACABA at all. There's no compulsion to tell ACABA what you're doing. They cannot investigate the roles. Indeed, Private Eye seems to know more about many of the roles than ACOBA does. I think the particular issue is in defence, where there's an absolute revolving door between senior military figures and the rather few defence contractors that are left, and there's an expectation that you go from a senior military role to a Ministry of Defence role into one of the procurement companies, and I think that's far too lax. You have what I call in the book a cohort system, where one cohort is lax on the future cohorts, and then that cohort gets into the same thing. So I think we've got to look at that. We've got to make it statutory. We've got to give it investigative powers, and to so that it can issue an injunction to prevent somebody acting in breach. I think it's only got about three staff as well. That seems very underwhelming.
Indeed, and I think you've already touched upon this somewhat in terms of what we've already been discussing, but to what extent do you believe that the lack of codification in our political system and the assumption that politicians are good actors, good chaps, has led to an inevitable, but of course inexcusable, abuse and corruption of our political system?
You know, it's a very interesting one, this, because what I don't look at in the book, maybe it's room for a further book, is whether there should be a written constitution. I think there's real arguments against that, not least, I can't say, in the present fractured political system, that there could be consensus about what should go in it. But I do think that there's room for codification of our conventions so that everybody knows where they stand. I think the role of Prime Minister, what the Prime Minister should do and not do, should be much clearer. And I think that there is a sense in which, because we've expected politicians to act in an ethical way, we haven't produced the more intrusive and perhaps more legalistic regulation that I think is appropriate now. So, yeah, I think it has left space for bad acting to take place.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We're coming towards the end of the podcast, John. Thank you for taking the time to speak to me, but I do have one final question. For anyone who reads the book, has read the book, what's the one thing that you hope that they, above anything else, take away from reading the book?
I think it's, well, if you'll permit me to say two things. I think the first thing would be that we can't rely on people being good chaps. We have to look at the system. The second thing is that the ethical regulators are too diffuse at the moment. They have too little power. They have too little investigative power. I don't think that a single ethical regulator is appropriate, because I think that would be a single point of failure. But I do think that the ethical regulators should work more closely together. And indeed, there is an issue, actually, that in some of the scandals of recent years, there have been several different bodies looking at the same thing. So in Greensill, there were four bodies looking at that. They actually all came to a similar conclusion. So that didn't, that was just extra work that didn't need to be done. In the case of the refurbishment of number 10, the independent advisor on members' interests effectively acquitted Johnson, and the Electoral Commission, which has an investigative role and is statutory, came to a much tougher verdict. So I think they need to work together. They all need to be put on a statutory basis so that they can't be abolished. I think those are the two main messages. But the book's got a few more messages in it, so I hope people read it.
No, absolutely. I mean, it has many more messages in it, I think, and I'm sure people will read it having listened to the podcast. Thank you once again for coming on, John. If people want to buy a copy of the book, where should they go to purchase a copy?
Any good bookshop, but it's published by Manchester University Press.
Fantastic. Thank you once again.